From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is early in the day yet, but we are raising a glass. Prohibition was repealed today in 1933. The 21st Amendment got the taps flowing again after the 18th Amendment effectively shut down the market for booze. Some effects still linger in Georgia, like dry counties and Sunday alcohol laws. The American Prohibition Museum in Savannah is the only museum of its kind in the country. It highlights the history of this period through the stories of its most colorful characters. And Kayla Black and Travis Spangenberg are here from the American Prohibition Museum in Savannah. Welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Travis, I'm going to start with you. 30-second recap, please, for the person who does not remember high school social studies. When and how did Prohibition happen?
Okay, so if you look back to the 1800s, what you had was this massive kind of alcoholism epidemic. They would have called it like drunkenness. Alcoholism wasn't really a term widely used at the time. People were drinking about three times what they drink today, and that's a low estimate. About 7 gallons of pure alcohol a year, which amounts to about 90 bottles of whiskey a year, and that's taking into account, that statistic includes all the teetotalers as well. So the average drinker was drinking a lot more than that, probably 3 or 4 bottles of whiskey a week, while I've had the same bottle of bourbon on my kitchen counter since July. Mm. So you had this epidemic of people just far too inebriated. And eventually, the women that were the real victims of the epidemic, the ones left husbandless and unable to provide for their family, got fed up and they launched a giant religious social movement to get rid of the thing that was terrorizing their lives and taking their loved ones from them.
And among those women, Carrie Nation, at the American Prohibition Museum, she greets visitors, and you've called yourself a Carrie fanatic. So what about her draws you in?
I love Carrie. I always tell Carrie Nation that, I always tell people that Carrie Nation, you don't have to agree with her, but you can sure admire her style. What I really enjoy about Carrie Nation is that her story goes far beyond someone who just smashed up bars. People can often view Carrie as a bit of a fanatic, a bit of a nut, because she's running into bars, smashing them up with a
hatchet. An axe, right?
Yeah, which was her trademark weapon that she named just about everything she ever created merchandise-wise after it. She had the Hatchet newsletter. She lived in Hatchet Hall in Arkansas. But the deeper story is that she was one of those women affected. The love of her life died when she was 21. She had a 1-year-old daughter. She had to leave him, killed her to do so. She had to leave him because he was so drunk all the time. And then he died 6 months after she left him. And that haunted her all her life. She was deeply kind to women who had also been victims of this. And she didn't hate drunks. She didn't hate alcoholics. She went to prisons and did prison outreach, talked to people who she believed were in that position because of what the drink did to them, not because of a deep failing on their part. She saw people's humanity.
Well, Kayla, that's one of the things that is represented in the museum. Alcoholism ruined Carrie Nation's marriage and so many others and led to the death of her husband, which are still serious problems that exist today, even if we don't drink as much. How does the museum tell that side of the story?
The museum likes to expand past those 13 years of prohibition and detail a lot of the things that came through prohibition, social changes, laws that are still in effect. We actually summarize the entire experience and then add about almost 100 years of history on the end of it about the unintended consequences of prohibition in our theater, where we show a short film at the end. A lot of people don't realize, but federal wiretapping happened for the first time during prohibition. The federal penitentiary system was started because of prohibition. The first women's prison was from prohibition. The war on drugs came from the end of prohibition and the Prohibition Bureau no longer having a real job to do. So the far-reaching tendrils of prohibition go into today. People don't drink as much as they used to. And thankfully so. So it doesn't look like Prohibition will be coming back anytime soon, but we still have the remnants of those 13 years left today.
And it was an important time for organized crime, which we will definitely get to. But I'm really interested in this idea of how women played a role. Of course, flappers hit the scene in the 1920s. They are associated with the speakeasies and moonshine and, you know, shucking off their bustles and corsets, cutting their hair. Women won the right to vote in 1920, and it seems like women were getting power and speaking out, even if they had opposing views on alcohol. Was this like the original year of the woman or decade?
Yeah, you could definitely say that. Women really found their own during Prohibition. They had gone from those corsets, the long dresses, the up to 30 pounds of clothing that they were wearing, even in the summertime. And folks like Christian Dior were coming out with these really short dresses. And Coco Chanel came out with her little black dress, which was supposed to be the go-to garment for the flapper, even though black had always traditionally been looked at as mourning clothing. They were wearing makeup. They were cutting their hair short, something that hairdressers were not okay with doing. Many women ended up going to barbers because they were the only people who would cut their hair. They were wearing their stockings rolled down and actually putting blush and rouge on their knees so that you could really emphasize this saucy kneecap that they were showing for the first time. And women were getting jobs. They were working as cigarette girls and speakeasies. They actually had to put bathrooms in establishments for the first time because men and women were going very scandalously to the bathrooms at the same place. And so they had ladies and men's powder rooms to go into. And it really all coalesced in the speakeasy. It was a place that was already sort of under the cover and not something that was, it was a little taboo to go to a speakeasy. And so women going unaccompanied by a man with a group of their girlfriends was just absolutely revolutionary. And that came from the temperance movement, from these ladies taking things into their own. They didn't have the right to vote at the time. And once they garnered the right to vote, it just sort of blossomed for them throughout that, through the 20s and into the 30s.
I'm speaking with Kayla Black and Travis Spangenberg from the American Prohibition Museum. That's in Savannah. Travis, let's talk about how Prohibition played out here in Georgia. Before the 18th Amendment banned alcohol consumption, that was 1919, Georgia was already on board with temperance. Was that all across the state?
Well, I wouldn't say so. The entire strategy of the Prohibition movement was to work it kind of piecemeal, where they started at the county level. If you could get a state to pass a local option law, which was a law that allowed counties to vote themselves dry, you could then work county by county and get enough where you can eventually get a dry state. Normally, that doesn't work very well in the urban areas. Atlanta, Savannah, certainly didn't go dry before they were made to. So in 1908, they had finally got so much of the state to go dry that the entire state went dry. Savannah was incensed. We have quite the culture today of our drinking habits. We have open carry for alcohol on the streets, but a lot of people, I don't think, realize that it goes way back farther than that. Savannah's always kind of enjoyed a good drink. And in 1908, certain people in Savannah were so angered by it, they threatened to become their own state. They were organizing to become the state of Chatham, which would have been a few of the outlying counties of Chatham County where Savannah is and Savannah itself, because they were so offended by this overreach into their culture. And eventually, I think they realized that it would be a lot simpler to just ignore the law and continue business as usual.
So Savannah's drinking culture, there were a lot of speakeasies, and that's something that we think of from the time. Bars with secret passwords, maybe a disguised doorway in an alley with a special knock opening up into an establishment. What were speakeasies like in Savannah during Prohibition? Kayla, do you want to pick that up?
Well, I'll say that that sort of glamorous idea of a speakeasy with the special knocks and the little passwords and stuff, that was very much the not norm. That would have been, people think of like the Cotton Club in New York City, the Crazy Cat in Washington, D.C. Those sorts of places have become iconic because of how many people went there. But the normal speakeasy was really just a location. It was a place where you could get alcohol. It could be in a basement. It could be the second floor of somebody's house. It could be in the back shop of a store. It wasn't necessarily this glitz and glamoury sort of location. So if you'd ask somebody, where can I go and get a drink, they would just give you an address. You'd go there, you'd knock and go in. By far, the most popular kind of speakeasy, quote unquote, in Savannah were Blind Pigs and Blind Tigers. Those were places where somebody would be advertising essentially a sideshow attraction, a blind pig, say, and you'd pay a nickel to go inside. And once you were inside, you'd realize that there is no blind pig, but there was alcohol. You were paying to see this blind pig, and then in return, you would be getting a free glass of alcohol. Savannah also had a system what they called locker clubs. A locker club was an organization where you paid dues, and the dues you were paying were to become a member of the locker club, not for the free alcohol that they provided at the locker club, but the membership itself. The Savannah Yacht Club actually served as a locker club during the time period. And because Savannah wasn't only upset about the fact that their culture was being threatened, but that they were going to lose several hundred thousand dollars worth of revenue from liquor sales and taxes, they ended up taxing the locker club system and ended up making just as much in taxes from the locker clubs that they had lost in revenue from alcohol.
So not as glamorous, but pretty elaborate and pretty, pretty lucrative.
Still sneaky.
Still sneaky in the end. Well, apparently Georgia never actually ratified the amendment to repeal prohibition. Is that true?
Yeah, I believe that is. There were several states, most of them southern or Midwest, that ignored it. You know, you needed a certain amount of states to ratify it. And once they got to that point, which I believe at the time was 36 states, the other ones that hadn't ratified it just left it on the table, which happened with the 18th Amendment as well, but kind of in the opposite way. The 18th Amendment prohibition, when that was ratified by the 36th, two states outright rejected it. Those were Connecticut and Rhode Island, and Maryland refused to enact any kind of enforcement code in their own laws. They basically said that the feds could come enforce it if they wanted to, and so that happened with the 21st Amendment as well. Luckily, the 21st Amendment allowed for states to regulate their own alcohol laws, so they didn't really need to ratify it to stay dry.
Well, during that time, if you turn on the radio, during Prohibition, you might have heard the voice of evangelical preacher Billy Sunday. Here's just a sample.
America needs a tidal wave of the old-time religion. America needs to be taken down to God's bathhouse and the hose turned on her. And the time isn't far distant when the wheels of God's judgment are going to go sweeping through this old God-hating world.
This old God-hating world, we get some fire and brimstone there from the preacher Billy Sunday. And we're talking today about Prohibition, the end of Prohibition, the repeal on December the 5th of 1933, long time ago. We're going to continue our conversation with Kayla Black and Travis Spangenberg from the American Prohibition Museum in Savannah. So stay with us. We'll be back with more on Second Thought. I just have to ask you guys before we go, do you have a favorite cocktail for this day? Travis? Kayla?
Let's go with the French 75.
I enjoy the Brown Derby.
Well, okay. We're going to pick up our conversation in just a minute. This is On Second Thought from Georgia Public Broadcasting. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're back with Kayla Black and Travis Spangenberg from the American Prohibition Museum in Savannah discussing the repeal of Prohibition 85 years ago today. Well, Travis, we just heard from a Baptist preacher, and even today, Georgia does have a lot of Baptists and a prevailing branch of Southern Baptists that does not allow members to drink alcohol. We heard that represented by those speaking out again recently against the brunch bill, the amendment that just passed to sell alcohol earlier on Sundays. Is the temperance movement alive in Georgia today?
I don't think so. Certainly not in the same way that it was at the time. It's always going to be people's personal choice and their religious choice to imbibe or not imbibe. Generally, what you see with prohibition laws and those relics of prohibition, things like blue laws, is that they don't get more restrictive these days. They're kind of falling apart. You don't see a lot of counties voting to go dry in the 21st century. You see, you know, in this case, an hour and a half added to Sunday sales. You see Sunday sales being allowed altogether and things like that across the country. So the sentiment is there. People are always going to believe that alcohol is something that can be a societal kind of drain. But I don't think that the temperance movement will reignite and take it from us again.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to. It's not considered a moral failing, but more biological and physical now, I think. But let's get back to some of these figures that are you talk about and represent at the museum. A prominent Savannah figure during Prohibition was Wolf Silver. He had a whiskey bootlegging strain. He transported liquor for Al Capone. He was also named Bo Peep. Who was he and how did he get that nickname?
Okay, so Wolf is one of my favorites. He was a rum runner here in Savannah. He had connections up to Chicago with Bugs Moran, and he was London-born, but he moved to Savannah when he was very young. And at some point, Bugs decided that he'd had enough of Wolf, and he was set up to be arrested, pulled in his entire crew, and he was the only member of his crew to escape that arrest. And so people started to say, oh, Bo Peep, he lost all his sheep because of his name Wolf. And the nickname kind of stuck. He ended up going to prison in the Savannah 4 raid. And he, when he got out, people were still calling him Bo Peep. So he opened up Bo Peep's Billiards Room on Congress Street, same street that the museum kind of borders and our speakeasy enters through. And a little ways down the road, though. And he served apparently the best roast beef sandwich in Savannah out of there and also alcohol, which Christ Church, his neighbor, was not a huge fan of. He did, however, open up a food, like a soup kitchen out of Christ Church to kind of be a good neighbor.
Right. And it was the distribution center for alcohol, all far reach. Kayla, another guy in Al Capone's employ in Savannah, Moose Helmy. He helped the legendary gangster fix up his rum runner cars out of his garage. So how did common people get involved and mixed up in this rum running gig?
Well, as far as Moose is concerned, it was sort of happenstance. In fact, it was just a situation in which one of Al Capone's vehicles in Savannah had gotten a little banged up, and they pulled into Moose's garage, which is off of Wright Square, downtown Savannah, and said, hey, I need you to fix this up, and once the car's fixed, take it over to the DeSoto Hotel and to the top penthouse floor, and we'll pay you and thanks a whole bunch. So he kind of became a little bit suspicious, but he fixed the car, took it, went up to that penthouse in the DeSoto, and it turns out that he had been working for Al Capone fixing this car. Al was so pleased with the work that he had done that he put Moose into his employ. And so what Moose used to do is make what he called shoe salesman cars, which essentially were cars that had tons of hidden compartments where you could put alcohol, your weaponry. And then he also helped Al with the very common practice that police had by trying to disable these rum runner cars is they would shoot out the radiator because that would almost immediately disable the vehicle. So what Moose and his guys would do is they would set up stations along the way where they could do these swap outs of radiators, and they became very good at it, so much so that they could just essentially pull one radiator out, pop the other one in, like a NASCAR pit stop, and the rum runners could keep going on their way. He became very, very essential to Al Capone here in Savannah. Years later, he would get his captain's license and become a boater. And his daughter, Captain Judy Helmy, actually still runs the family business today off of Wilmington Island in Savannah.
So we think of these big folks in New York and Chicago in the typical gangster image, but there were a load of people who were bootleggers. Savannah had its own history and collective with low country residents. Do we have any idea how much moonshine was produced and transported on Georgia roadways?
No. It was a massive amount. In fact, they called Savannah the spigot of the South. We were just perfectly placed among the marshes and the jetties of the Atlantic coast to be just secretive enough where the federal boats could not navigate those small waterways, but the locals knew well enough where they could get a boat, where they could dock, where they could sneak in. You can see all over the Lowcountry remnants of this. There's a Beer Can Island where there are stills located. Obviously, it gets its name from the large number of beer cans located on it. If you go to Skidaway Island State Park, which is part of the National Parks or the State Park Service, there are a few stills that you can see today. And if you walk away from those stills, you can see exactly where those moonshiners would have pulled their boats up onto the shores of the park and walked in and cooked their moonshine, loaded up, and went. There were speakeasies in the marshes of Wilmington Island, one specifically called Greens, where depending on the color of the buoys that they put up meant that there was alcohol at the bottom of the buoy or not, so you could pull up the bottle and or the jug. It's hard to tell how much was carried on Georgia roads, but so much so that the moonshine runners who actually did transport that liquor became pretty competitive with one another and started NASCAR up in northern Georgia because of it.
This is just a fascinating history and so much laid out there. We get Moose, Bo Peep, Saucy Kneecaps, a fascinating job and a fascinating conversation. Kayla Black and Travis Spongenberg from the American Prohibition Museum in Savannah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a museum that CNN Travel calls the best bar in Savannah. Imagine that for a museum. So if you're there, you can celebrate the repeal of Prohibition with Kayla and Travis at the museum starting at 6 o'clock. And more details can be found on our website, gpb.org.